welcome to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Dr. Mark Gulston. Now, this is a show for raw, honest conversations about the hurts in our lives and how we get ourselves past them. And we have guests from all around the world, which is fitting because I'm on the East Coast of Scotland and Mark is on the West Coast of America. And we have another fabulous guest with us today, Stacey Friedenthal. And Mark, I'll let you do a proper introduction because I know her work is very close to your heart, isn't it? And I think I pronounced Stacey's name correctly there, didn't I?
You did. Thank you.
You're welcome, Stacey.
You did very well, JJ. Anyway, Stacey and I met when she was a guest on my podcast, My Wake Up Call, and she went from suicidal to being a suicidologist. At that time, we discussed her book, Helping the Suicidal Person, Tips and Techniques for Professionals. And she has a recent book out, which she's going to introduce to us. And you can find out more about her work at speakingofsuicide.com. And Stacey, great to see you again and hear from you again.
Thank you. It's great to be on one of your podcasts again and to meet JJ.
Great to see you. Yeah. So, I mean, I'd never heard the word suicidologist before. It's
a lot of people think
a real word, though. Yeah.
The Oxford English Dictionary says so. So,
oh, well,
then it must be right. But Microsoft Word says it's not, because whenever I type it, it gets a little red squiggly line underneath it.
Oh, well, what does Microsoft know, really? Yeah.
Exactly. I'll go with the Oxford Dictionary.
Exactly.
You know, Stacey, I may have mentioned one of my mentors, one of my early mentors was a fellow named Dr. Edwin Schneidman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, He's considered the father of suicidology.
Right. No, and he loved to coin terms that, so I think he may have coined the term suicidologist. His work also went into death and dying. So he was a professor of thanatology at UCLA, and he was the only professor of thanatology in the world because he made up the word.
I was going to say, what on earth does that even mean?
Thanatos is death, everything about death. But Stacey, it's good to see you again, and our listeners. My guess is they know someone who's been suicidal. They may have someone in their family who's suicidal. And so we were so looking forward to having you here. Tell us a little bit about your story of suicidal to suicidologist and where you are with it, and we'll have at it.
Sure. Excuse me. So I come at this field from a place of personal and professional interest. And the personal interest is that pretty early on, around the age of 11 or 12, I myself began having suicidal thoughts. And I had them on and off through adolescence. And then in my 20s, things really came to the fore. And I attempted suicide. And I never could have forecast that those experiences would have given me gifts to carry forward. You know, at the time, of course, when you're in that state of mind, you feel tremendously hopeless and have trouble seeing even 5 minutes ahead, let alone 5 years ahead, and then 25 years ahead, which is where I am now, maybe even close to 30. So after that experience, I volunteered at a suicide hotline. And that was just very, very rewarding work. And I was a little worried because it wasn't that long after I had been hospitalized for a suicide attempt. And I was a little worried, like, am I too fragile to volunteer at a hotline? And it was the opposite. It was just a chance for me to be supremely mindful of the other person and to really pay attention to what they were saying. And it kind of took me out of my own head in that regard. And so then I got my social work degree, my master's in social work, and all my work after that touched on suicidality in some way. I mean, I mainly worked in emergency settings, like a psychiatric emergency room, excuse me, and a medical emergency room, things like that. And so what I kept seeing was that people were waiting very, very long to get help. And I had also had that question in high school. A friend of mine died by suicide, and I always wondered, why didn't he tell anybody and why didn't he get help? And so I decided to get my PhD to investigate those questions. And here I am 20 years later, almost 20 years after getting my PhD. And I've written two books on suicide, the one you mentioned, Helping the Suicidal Person, Tips and Techniques for Professionals. And then a new one that came out last month called Loving Someone with Suicidal Thoughts. It has a long subtitle. It's What Family, Friends, and Partners Can Say and Do. And I run the website speakingofsuicide.com, and I'm thinking of suicide every day, but in a very different way than I did in my 20s.
You triggered something. Part of my practice as a psychiatrist was focused on suicide prevention and suicidal people. And one of the most suicidal people I'd seen, she got through it. And she said, you know, the miracle of where I am now is not that I didn't kill myself. It's that I'm glad to be alive. And I remember she had lived with the suicidality and multiple attempts for years. And I said, go out and live life, go out and do things. And she said, and this, I'm bringing this up, if you had this experience when you went into the suicide hotline, she said, knowing what I know and what I've lived through, it's so meaningful, especially when I realize so many other people are going through it. I can't take another job. I can't take another job where I'm, you know, working retail or selling something, because it's just too much a part of my identity, you know, having felt this for years and having gotten through it. So can you relate to any of that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to me, it's, you know, I'm biased, of course, because this is how I spend my days, but it's the most meaningful work I could do. And I love what she said about not just being alive, but being glad to be alive, because one of the criticisms of suicide prevention from people who are struggling with suicidal thoughts is they'll say, you just want me to stay alive and suffer. And it's not dichotomous like that. It's not, you know, either end your whatever you're dealing with and die by suicide or stay alive and suffer. There's also the option of staying alive and wanting to be alive or being glad to be alive. And so that's something that I really strive for with my clients. It's not just about risk assessment and safety planning as a therapist. It's what comes after that.
Yeah, and it's struck me when you were speaking just then, Stacey, that you said that you had your first thoughts when you were, what, about 11, 10, that sort of age. And I also had, similar thoughts going through my head at about the same age. And I'm just wondering whether that's common or how common that is for children to have these thoughts. We hear a lot about teenagers and adults having suicidal thoughts, but not so much in my experience of kids, you know, who haven't even gone to high school yet, having thoughts like that. Is that common?
It's surprisingly more common than people would expect. I wouldn't say it's, you know, very common. And I don't remember the exact statistic off my head. It may be around 5 to 8%. But what we do know is that puberty is a big trigger, in that the rates of suicidal thoughts go up tremendously when you look at the ages of puberty. And so it makes sense that, you know, you said 10 or 11, I was 11 or 12. And so that's really, you know, when that process tends to begin.
Yeah, well, that would make sense for me if we're talking about it coming on around puberty. Yeah. And Mark, you, I know that in the film that you executive produced, What I Wish My Parents Knew, you have kids not that much older giving their thoughts on when they first felt this way, don't you?
Yeah, Stacey, and I'll send you a link to it. Executive producer of a a documentary called What I Wish My Parents Knew.
And, oh, wow.
And since I had the interview with you, I've become close friends with a fellow named Jason Reed, and his 14-year-old son died by suicide 5 years ago. And his son left a suicide note saying, "Tell my story." And it's available on Amazon Prime. There was a documentary that he did where he spoke to treatment centers, families, parents, experts. I met him because I was one of the experts. And but what was really most riveting was when teenagers talked about their low point, which they weren't currently in, but it was riveting. And so in this new documentary, What I Wish My Parents Knew, he interviews, I think, 9 or 10 teenagers, and he basically says, "Tell me about your lowest point." And I'll share this with you, and I've probably shared this for parents listening in, but he'll make his presentation. We'll show the video. He'll do his presentation about everything that he wished he had known, but he didn't. And every time I watch it, you know, it reveals things to me. And tell me if either of you can sort of relate to this, because one of the things I tell parents who are watching it is write down these 5 words: complain, blame, excuses, threats, moody. Complain, blame, excuses, threats, moody, because that's what a lot of teenagers are. And when teenagers are that way, maybe you can think back to your teen years, is it triggers parents to not be empathic. Because triggered parents, you know, well, what's wrong? Why don't you talk about it? And so what happens is what these teenagers talk about in the video is, I couldn't tell my parents because they don't experience their parents as empathic, and they don't realize that they have triggered them with complain, blame, excuses, threats, moody. And these teenagers are none of that in this film. It's just their raw vulnerability. So what happens is parents watching it, they're mesmerized because they realize that's what's going on inside my teenager. And they go home and they start to cry. And their teenagers say, "What's the matter, Mom? What's the matter, Dad?" And they look at them and they say, "I just realized how much I love you." Mm. So I've been looking for a vehicle for 25 years that could change the conversation between parents and teens during those years. So I'll ask each of you, you know, going back to when you had those feelings, can you understand what I just said, that it was easy to feel alone because it felt like if you brought it up to your parents, that we don't bring it up in a raw, vulnerable way?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I could never have really explained my feelings to my parents. Wouldn't have dreamt of doing it. You know, they just didn't create the atmosphere, or, you know, I didn't feel safe enough to do that. And that's partly a generational thing, because they wouldn't have been brought up in that kind of atmosphere or relationship either. You know, their families were both difficult. They grew up just before the two world wars. You know, these were very different times, and you weren't really expected to open up about feelings, and children were seen and not heard. You know, quite a lot of the time, you behaved yourself, and that was your duty. So bringing up these raw feelings wasn't really the thing for me. I don't know about you, Stacey.
Yeah, I kind of had an opposite situation in that my mother, she wasn't yet a therapist, but she eventually became a therapist. And so she, you know, was very into talking about feelings. And I, as an adolescent, kind of recoiled and went behind a wall. And there are two things that stand out from your question, Mark, that I've been thinking about. One is, I remember when I was like 11 or 12 and my mother was trying to get me to talk about what I was going through. And she said, "You know, I was young. I was your age once too." And I remember, you know, I was an intelligent kid, but I remember thinking, "No, you weren't." Like, I just couldn't picture that. In my mind, she had always been an adult. And then the other thing that stands out in my mind, and actually this is really sad, and so I feel like, you know, kind of trigger warning, because here I was just laughing and now I'm going to say something really sad. But I remember when my friend died when I was 15 years old. And I mean, I remember that morning very vividly, like, you know, when the phone call came and what we talked about. And I had just seen him the night before, like less than 12 hours earlier. And I went into the den and my mother was in there, and I told her, and she started crying, and she said, "Will you promise me that if you ever have suicidal thoughts, you'll tell me?" And I lied. And I said, "Of course." And then I went outside and sat on the curb. And I just remember that morning so clearly. I sat on the curb and the sky was just this bright blue. And I thought, like, why did he leave this sky? But I didn't talk to her. You know, I just was like this wall.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to her? Did you ever talk to her about it? Sorry, Mark.
No, go ahead.
In my 20s, I did. So when I became very, very depressed, like up until my 20s, I'd had bouts, I would say, you know, where I would have kind of brief episodes. And then as I got older, they got worse and longer and more intense. And so I really hit a low point when I was about 20, 25. And then I started talking to her about it and to my father, although he, you know, my father was a chemical engineer, so he was a very, very not into talking about feelings. So when I first told them what I was going through, my dad's response was, "Well, you need to exercise and take a vitamin pill." And my mother's response was, you know, very, very empathetic and, you know, very emotion oriented.
Well, I think a lot of people will empathize and recognize those responses there. We've just got to take a break quickly here now, though. We'll be back with more from Stacey, me, and Dr. Mark Goulston right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston. And we still have our guest, Stacey Friedenthal, with us.
So, Stacey,
I'm still here.
You are still here.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad you're not suicidal today.
Yeah. But,
oh, my gosh.
but before the break, you were saying how that when your mother asked you about your feelings, you recoiled. Mm-hmm. And so if you can drill down, what is it that caused you to recoil? Because it sounds like she was concerned, she was caring, she was not wanting to trigger you to recoil. So can you inform us about that? Because I think parents are listening in saying, yeah, how do I get my child to open up when they're in a bad place?
Sure. I don't know. This might have been unique to me. It may not be something that all adolescents deal with. And then again, it may. But I was very close to my mother when I was younger. And, you know, she was like my best friend. And she didn't do anything wrong. But the normal developmental phase of adolescence is that you begin to pull away. And so I had pulled away, and I think I just felt like that was a little child thing for me to be close to her, and that I could handle things on my own, or I could talk to my friends, but I didn't need to be a child, you know, that I was older than that. And then it's ironic, because then in my 20s, I began confiding in her, and I was even older than as an adolescent. And actually, I mean, we are still very close, and I can talk with her about anything, and I love her very much. But in my adolescent years, I think I felt like it was weak or childish to talk with my parents about anything, or really my mother, because I wouldn't have talked with my father as an adolescent. He was very practical and concrete. And so we didn't really talk about emotions much, but I think that was it. And I do know that just in the adolescence that I've spoken with in my own practice, that a lot of kids are worried about how their parents will react. And I actually have a post on my website, speakingofsuicide.com, and the title is something like 10 Reasons Adolescents Don't Tell Their Parents About Suicidal Thoughts. And one of the biggest reasons is fear that the parents will get upset or that they'll get mad, you know, and that is surprisingly common, where a parent says, how could you even think of suicide with everything I've given you, you know, or with how much you have such a good life. How could you even think of that? Or how could you think of hurting us like that? You know, it would be so painful if you died. How could you think of doing that? And so a lot of adolescents, they're worried about their parents' reaction. And then a lot of adolescents are worried about, will they be sent to a hospital? And there's all sorts of negative stereotypes about hospitals, some well-founded and some not as well-founded. And so there's a lot of fear around that. So I think, you know, one of the first things a parent can do if they are worried about a child is tell them, I want to listen, you know, and I'm not going to panic. I'm not going to take it personally. I mean, what you said about parents losing their ability to be empathy because of the complain, blame, excuses, threats, and moody, I relate to very much as a parent myself. Our son just turned 23 last week. And I remember there was this shift from when he was a child, you know, a younger child, to when he entered adolescence. There was a shift in me that I began to take things more personally. And up until then, I'd been able to separate and think like, oh, he's hurt or he's angry, and sort of play an observer role and stay curious. But then as he got older and became, you know, very much very moody, I began taking it personally and feeling defensive. And if I could do it over again, I would do that differently.
I'm retired now, so I'm not licensed to practice, but I will speak to parents and I'll speak to counselors and therapists. And recently I was speaking with a couple who's, I think their eighth grader has really just turned very, very negative, you know. And so one of the things we talked about, which they're going to try, and maybe on a future episode, I'll tell you how it worked, JJ. We talked about using reverse psychology. So I suggested to the mother, you know, who's the more, you know, emotionally caring person, but he rejects her because he doesn't want to be a mama's boy. And the dad is a problem solver. I mean, he's into, you know, and he gets that his child's in a tough place, but he wants to convert it into a problem to be solved. So the reverse psychology thing we came up with, and she smiled saying, oh, I can't wait to try it. What it looks like is, if you're this worried parent, but especially the mom who's more into emotions, I said, I'd like you to knock on the door and say, can I come in? And he'll, what's this about? Can I come in? I want to run something by you. And hopefully he'll say, okay. And then what I suggested she say to him is, I want to try something, and just humor me, or just tell me to get the heck out. I'd like you to look at me and repeat these words and pretend you feel them. Mom, can you get off my effing back with the feeling stuff already? Every time you do it, it makes me feel worse. Don't you get it? You are so clueless, Mom. I mean, you're as clueless as Dad. Could you do me a favor? Just get off my back with it already, because you make me nuts. So, honey, could you say that to me? So it's reverse psychology. And then, and she was, I mean, I had the couple on the phone and she said, oh my God. I said, because what you really want to do, there's a term called mediated catharsis. So what you want to do is give him the words to get the anger off his chest using his words, as opposed to leave me alone and just throwing himself into video games. And parents who have tried this, some of them report, they say, you know, I've done it with my teenager. And then when he'll say the words begrudgingly, I'll goad him and say, come on, you can do better than that. And I'll get him to just fume at me. And then a couple parents have said, my teenagers have started giggling. And I said, because they hate hating you. They don't know where it comes from. And if they had said that on their own, you'd say, calm down, you better take a time out. And so they keep it inside. But by giving them a channel to get it off their chest as deeply, using as much swear words as possible, if they can safely get it off their chest, they feel grateful to you, because they don't want to hate you and they don't know where it comes from. But they just do. Can you track with any of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, me too. Definitely. Yeah. I can imagine what it would have been like when I was younger if my parents had done that. Now, the thing that was going through my head as you were talking about it, and I think it's just fantastic, by the way. I think all parents should give it a go. But what was going through my head when you were talking was that, you know, parents have to have a certain amount of emotional maturity to be able to do that, right? And not all parents do. Certainly my parents wouldn't have had that emotional maturity to handle that. And again, you know, it was a completely different generation. We didn't go and seek professional help as often as we might do today. So, yeah, but I think it would have been fantastic if they'd done that. It really would. Bursts the bubble.
Yeah, something you can say to parents, and Stacey, I hope this is helpful, is if they're sort of resisting it, one of the things that gets through to them is to say, do me a favor. Stop BSing yourself and me. What's happening is you are so afraid of your teenager and you feel so powerless, and you don't do fear and powerless well. And every time you're feeling afraid because you heard of some kid dying by suicide in their high school or whatever, every time you get afraid and feel powerless, it brings out the worst in you. You know, and then often they can track with that, and they'll pause and they'll say, and sometimes they'll start to cry and they'll say, I feel that all the time with my kid.
Hmm.
So I hope that makes sense, but.
Oh, it's very powerful. And I think, you know, there's a lesson in there that so many actions we regret or have difficulty carrying out that we know we should or whatever are based in fear. And it's also a place, kind of a doorway to empathy too, mm-hmm. that when someone is being angry or defensive or, you know, I'm thinking of the parent, but also the adolescent, that it's from a place of fear, and we can try to have compassion. Now, that also requires tremendous presence of mind when someone's being triggered by what the other person says.
Well, one of the reasons JJ and I came up with the show, and we won't bore you with the all the different titles we were thinking about for the show.
There were a lot. Let me just tell you, there were lots of them.
I know. And JJ was very patient with me because it'd be like, not another one. But I think we came up with this because we believe that there is a global conspiracy is a bad word, but there's a global epidemic where people run from hurt and fear into coping mechanisms that relieve them for the moment, but are destructive. And if people can just be able to stay in the hurt and fear, you know, not dwell in it, not ruminate, but just stay in it enough to feel it and find that person where they can say, look, I've been married, it'll be 45 years. And when my wife and I get into some tiffs, it doesn't bring out the best in either of us. And what I'll try and do is bring it back to what's going on. And I'll say, you know, yes, I am frustrated, but I'm not angry. What I am is I'm hurt, you know, because my wife's much more practical than I am. And I'm the serial creative. And JJ, we have a good friendship, but, you know, I could drive anyone crazy who's practical with all this creative stuff. And so, and she might sort of say, are you manic? And I'm a psychiatrist. I'd say, not today. Actually, years ago, this is too much information, but I don't care. She doesn't listen to these things anyway. Years ago, I said to her, in a moment of reflection, I said, if I wasn't married to you, I'd be on lithium. And she said,
oh my gosh.
And she said in a very empathic voice, high doses.
I'm just laughing because last week my husband was in Australia and I said to a friend, I think he's my external lithium.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's the guardrails. And so I so appreciate it. And I think there's some truth to that because what brings me down sometimes when my creativity is flirting with a little bit of hypomania is I'm very duty bound to my marriage, my children, my grandchildren. And I like that. I like that it reins me in. But occasionally I will say, and this is getting back to the anger, I say, look, I'm not angry. I'm not, but I am hurt that when I get creative, you believe so little in me. Mm-hmm. And I understand, well, she's worried, you know, mm-hmm. and I said, look, if I haven't gone off the rails in 45 years, she says, yeah, but I'm the rail. She said, I'm the rail. I'm pretty banged up.
Wow. But it's fantastic that you have somebody in your life like that. And just in case nobody knows what, or somebody out there doesn't know what lithium is, it calms people down. Do we call them tranquilizers these days?
I think
it's a mood stabilizer.
A mood stabilizer. There you go. That's what it's called. Yeah. And guess what? It's time for us to take another break right now. But we'll be back with more right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and Dr. Mark Goulston, plus our special guest today, Stacey Friedenthal. And Stacey, I want to hear a little bit more, or lots more, actually, about your new book. It sounds really, really interesting. Tell us about it.
Sure. It's called Loving Someone with Suicidal Thoughts, What Family, Friends, and Partners Can Say and Do. And it's sort of like my first book, but it's for lay people instead of professionals, because my first book was Helping the Suicidal Person, Tips and Techniques for Professionals. And when I started my website, speakingofsuicide.com, I kind of had in mind that it was for people with suicidal thoughts. I mean, I knew it was for everybody who's affected by suicide or suicidality in some way, you know, as a loved one, as a survivor, as somebody going through it currently. But I really thought primarily it was for people with suicidal thoughts. But people who I've heard from as much as people with suicidal thoughts are friends and parents and others who say, what do I do? You know, my partner has suicidal thoughts and I feel so helpless. I don't know what to do. Or I'm worried that they have suicidal thoughts, but I don't know how to ask, you know? And so that's what this book is for, is people who don't know what to say, they don't know what to do, and for people who are having trouble emotionally because of the stress of their partner or love or child or other loved one having suicidal thoughts, and ways they can take care of themselves and also navigate some of the hard parts, you know, that there can be conflicts that come up because of what people are dealing with when they have suicidal thoughts. There can be, you know, the person who on the outside can get angry, like, why aren't you getting help? Or why aren't you doing the things that you're supposed to be doing to feel better? And in the United States, why aren't you getting the gun out of the house? Because yeah. Firearms are such a big deal here. And sometimes people can feel manipulated by someone who has suicidal thoughts. And I hate saying that because I don't want to feed the myth that talking about suicide is manipulative, or, you know, someone just wants it, quote, just wants attention. And there are times where people can feel manipulated. That doesn't necessarily mean the other person is being manipulative, you know? Okay. And so the book goes into all those different things. And then one of the key chapters that I keep getting a lot of feedback on is titled Brave Listening. And it's about, I define brave listening as asking the questions whose answers you fear and listening to what's hard to hear. And
nice. I like that. Yeah.
You like that. That clicked. Mm. And really going into, you know, all the human reactions somebody may have if a person they care about says they have suicidal thoughts. You know, you immediately want them to feel better. You want them to stop thinking of suicide. You want to be able to not worry, and really needing to put aside those needs and hearing what is hard to hear without trying to immediately change the person's mind or tell them they're wrong, or, you know, that it'll get better, which, you know, is an important message, but prematurely it can shut down conversation.
You know, I think that's wonderful, and it is brave listening. And something that I'll encourage people to do is to drill down deeper, as opposed to out of your own anxiety try to shut them down or reassure them or minimize it or tell them to go get help. And one of the ways you can drill deeper is, and a lot of it is not just what you say, it's your tone. So you're not just checking a box. They need to feel like you really care. But you can ask questions like, when did this start? Mm-hmm. How long's it been going on? When was the first time you felt this? I would try and stay away from sometimes questions like why, because that can make people feel defensive. And I think another question is, tell me about times when it's been the worst for you, mm-hmm. When it was almost unbearable.
Yeah.
And what'd you think? You know, what was going on? What was your impulse? What did you do? Or what did you want to do? So the more you can sort of keep them talking, but the tone has to be, I want to help you feel less alone, as opposed to being clinical and checking boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that why question, half the time people don't know why. You can't mm-hmm. actually put your finger on why. It's just how you feel.
It goes back to our show title. This mentor of mine, Dr. Edwin Schneidman, if you look at him up, Schneidman, he was one of the pioneers in suicide prevention. And one of the things he taught me is that when he would sit down with people, he would say, what hurts most? Mm. And he would use the word, how long does it hurt? Tell me about times when you didn't think you could bear the hurt another moment. But it was very much geared towards enabling them and inviting them to get that off their chest. And what I liked about it is hurt is a non-clinical term. When you use things like depressed, such and such, Many people feel like you're already labeling them that they're mentally ill, that there's something wrong with them. But hurt is universal. That's why we have this show. But Stacey, you were about to say something.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many different ideas that have come into mind. I'm not sure which one I was about to say. So I really like, Mark, that the way we think very similarly, because what I've observed, I'm one as somebody who needed to be listened to, and then somebody who is listening, is that there are responses that can open the person up, and then there, you know, can invite the person to say more, and then there are responses that can shut the conversation down. And oh, I know what I was going to say a moment ago, which is that one of the unfortunate things that can happen when someone discloses suicidal thoughts is that the person they've disclosed to gets so scared and anxious that now you've got the person with suicidal thoughts reassuring them that they won't do anything and that they're okay and not to worry. And so the focus has shifted from the person who's hurting so badly that they're thinking of ending their life to the person who's scared of hearing that. And then that can really deter people from opening up more. And they may even lie and say, no, I don't really think that way. I mean, I every now and then, you know, and they may feel protective and not share as much. But another thing I wanted to say is that, you know, when you were talking about what hurts the most is I have a very dear friend. And in our 20s, you know, we kind of went through suicidal experiences together. And she called me once and she was very upset. It was the middle of the night and she had called a suicide hotline and she was very angry because the man kept trying to cheer her up. Mm-hmm. Like he kept saying, this will pass and this is temporary and, you know, you'll feel better in the morning, you know, things like that. And she was very angry. And I wasn't a social worker yet. I was a newspaper reporter at the time. And I said, well, what did you want him to say? I was naive. I thought like he was trying to help. And why didn't that help? And I said, what did you want him to say? And this has always stuck with me. She said, I wanted him to say, what is it like?
Yeah. What is it? Acknowledge. Yeah.
What is it like to be hurting that badly?
Yeah.
And so she wanted to be able to tell her story without immediately being invalidated or minimized or talked out of it.
Well, that's a wonderful question. What is it like to be hurting that badly?
Yeah.
You know, years ago, I asked someone who I was working with, I said, what helps? What helps in our meeting? Yeah. And he said, I'm a burden to everyone. I either anger my parents or I scare them. My siblings think I'm manipulative, which I am. My life isn't particularly happy, so my life is a burden. So I think, why don't I just relieve everyone, including me, of the burden of me? And he said, what helps is when I saw you or when I see you, you have this incredible smile that you're glad to see me, which is not tied to whether I'm doing anything. I mean, whether I'm following, meds or I'm following anything. And he said, I thought you were crazy. You know, you smiled in a way that and he said, what I learned is I'm not a burden to you. You know, and he said, I still think you're crazy, Doc, but when you feel like you're a burden to everyone, including yourself, very tempting to just say, well, why don't I relieve the world and me of that burden?
It's such a painful feeling to have.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. What are you thinking, JJ? I can see some wheels spinning in your head. Or maybe you're just busy keeping the time.
No. We are coming close to ending the show, though. No, I was just thinking how... I was thinking back to when I was younger and thinking back to the various times when I felt that I wanted to end it all. And it wasn't that I felt that I was a burden and so therefore might as well end it all. I just couldn't see a way out of it, whatever it was. And I've talked before on the show about this feeling of being completely paralyzed. completely paralyzed by, I don't know, whether depression, feeling that everything was going wrong, that I couldn't do anything right, but not feeling that I was a burden, but just not being able to see a way forward out of anything. And yet I was still working. I was still holding down, you know, a job or work anyway. Yeah, it was just that feeling that life was just one big sticky mess that I couldn't pull myself out of like quicksand. And I did say before that I'd gone through all, at one point went through all the ways that I could actually end it all. But and then realized that I couldn't actually do any of it. And I couldn't actually go that far. But it didn't stop the feelings, and it didn't stop the me getting to the point where I just wondered whether that wouldn't just be the right way to go, if that makes sense.
Oh, that makes total
a lot
sense.
Of sense.
And not seeing a way through it or way out, I think that's a very common feeling. Yeah, yeah. What are some of your thoughts as we're coming towards the end, Stacey?
About what JJ said, you mean, or just in general?
Yeah, what JJ, but in general, you know, you've been a wonderful guest, and I've certainly learned a lot. So
I just think this is such an important conversation, and a lot of people, they're scared to have it. And, you know, they're scared. There are these myths that if you ask about suicidal thoughts, you know, if you ask someone if they're having suicidal thoughts, that then you're giving them the idea or you're triggering them to become suicidal. And we know that's not true. There's been numerous studies that have looked at that systematically, and it's just not true. I mean, everybody already knows about suicide. You know, you're not introducing something novel. There's research that young children know about suicide before they even know the word suicide. They know that some people intentionally end their life. And so I think, you know, we need to really try to create a culture where it's okay to talk about suicidal thoughts, and the person can feel heard and not judged and not shut down. And through that process, and also not, you know, that the other person doesn't freak out and immediately call the police or something, which I've heard of people doing, and that through that process, hopefully, ideally, people will be less inclined to act on suicidal thoughts because they won't feel so alone. And because in talking about it with others, they will be able, you know, again, ideally, to see options that go beyond ending one's life.
Yeah, yeah, that's very important. It's very important to not feel that you're alone at that point and be able to reach out to somebody who can hear you. Stacey, if anybody is wanting to look you up, find out what you're doing, get your book, you've got a website, haven't you? So tell us where people can find out more about you and your work.
Sure. I've got two websites. Actually, three, but the third is kind of a neglected child. It's the youngest.
I know that feeling, yeah.
So the first one is stacyfriedenthal.com, and that's StaceyFriedenthal. And that is focused more on me specifically and my work and things like that. And then I have the site speakingofsuicide.com, which is absolutely not focused on me. It's focused on all things, you know, related to suicide and suicidality. But there is a section in that website about, you know, titled about me or about the author or something like that, where people can get more information. And JJ, I would be remiss. I feel like there's a door that's been left open and the wind is getting in. And so I don't want to neglect it, but thank you for sharing what you did. And it's so sad that you felt that way, that you felt that there was nothing that you could do and felt paralyzed.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But, you know, I did manage to get through it and I'm still here. So that's good. And
that's very good.
I'm happy about that. And so hopefully people will take something away from that and understand that it doesn't have to be the end. Right. So, but it does have to be the end of this show, unfortunately. Mark, do you want to have one last word before we go?
One last word. And it came out when you said, what's it like to be hurting that much? One of my mentors was Larry King from CNN.
And oh, wow.
we'd have breakfast together for a couple of years before COVID. And I was in this quirky group that met every morning. And one of his sayings was, you can't be curious and furious at the same time. And I think it's true. You can't be curious and fearful at the same time. So I think when you say to someone, what's it like for it to hurt so much? So that's a very curious question. And I think asking it can lessen your fear, and lessening your fear can open the door for them to open up to you. So this has just been wonderful.
I say one more thing real quickly.
Yeah.
One of my favorite quotes, and this is misattributed to some famous poet, you know, but it's really just something that the internet is saying. But the quote is, be curious, not judgmental.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that can be, you know, modified to be curious, not fearful. Yeah. Or really, really, actually, I'm going to revise that and say, be fearful, but still be curious, because you can't help it if you feel fearful. But ask the questions anyway.
Love that. Stacey, thank you so, so much. You know, it's been fantastic having you on the show today. And
thank you.
On behalf of Mark and I, we are both very, very grateful. And to everybody listening, this is the end of the show, finally. And we hope that you'll join us again on Hurt Less, Live More another time here on UK Health Radio and the UK Health Radio podcast. But for now, from Mark and me and Stacey, thanks for listening.